Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Leaf, and welcome to my podcast, Cleaning Up the Mental Mess. What makes for a happy life, a fulfilling life, a good life? According to the directors of the Harvard Study of Adult Development, the longest scientific study of happiness ever conducted, the answer to this question may be simpler than you think. And on today's podcast, I have one of the authors and directors of this research with me, Dr. Robert Waldinger, whose TED talk on the subject is the most viewed of all time with nearly 44 million views. In 1938, the first of its kind study set out to approach the study of human life in radically new ways, focusing on what makes us healthy rather than what makes us sick. Since then, thousands of participants, including John F. Kennedy, have answered lengthy questionnaires and hundreds have had their blood drawn, their brain scanned, and have been interviewed regularly by the study researchers. Data has been collected over decades and reveals the broad and enduring power of relationships in the shaping of our health, longevity, and happiness. In today's podcast with Dr. Robert Waldinger, we discuss how much of our happiness is actually under our control, what social fitness is and how to exercise it, how close relationships at work can boost productivity, what we get wrong about achievement, the first step someone can take if they want to live a really good life, and the importance of how deep, meaningful connections are vital in happiness, and so much more. Let's begin today's podcast. Dr. Robert Waldinger, wow, what an honor to interview a giant in this field. I mean, it's just your work is outstanding. You are a leader in your field on every aspect, and your approach to how you handle the world of psychiatry and the combination of that with your Zen, being a Zen master, and your work on happiness. It's such a privilege to interview you. So thank you so much for agreeing to join me today.
Well, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's my absolute pleasure. Can we begin with just a little bit of a story on your background? You know, tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, and why you got into writing this. Or you've published extensively, but we're going to be talking a lot about your book, The Good Life. And people have heard it in the introduction, but you have basically been running the longest study of a scientific study of happiness ever conducted, supported by many other studies. And just before I hand over to you, I just want to reiterate, there is such a wealth of knowledge out there around happiness, and it's also become very trendy. You know, there's like as though there's a pull for happiness, and it's become very externalized. And you really look at the science and the research behind that and have conducted the longest study on happiness and have come to some incredible logical gut conclusions that if you really have to ask ourselves, what is happiness? What you have discovered and shown is really going back to the basics of how we as humans function. So let me hand over to you.
Sure. So I'm a psychiatrist. I have been working for 40 years in psychiatry. I trained actually as a psychoanalyst. So my clinical specialty is talk therapy, is doing therapy with people. And I see people every day for talk therapy. And then in addition, I retrained to become a researcher once I was already a clinician. And then about 20 years ago, I stumbled into a Zen group and found a teacher and have been practicing Zen meditation and now teaching Zen meditation ever since. And those three windows on life, my clinical work with people, my Zen meditation, and my research have really come together to help me sort of understand the human experience from these different angles. And that's really what I love and what I care about, which is trying to understand in as many ways as we can the experience of being alive and being human.
I love that. And okay, let's talk about the study now. Let's talk about that you have actually conducted the longest study on happiness.
So the study started in 1938, and it's incredibly rare for two reasons. One is that in 1938, it was a study of human thriving. Most research up until that point had been studying what goes wrong in human development, understandably, so we can help people. But this study was about what predicts who's going to be happy and healthy as they go through their life. So it was radical for 1938. The other thing that is so unusual is that we have studied the same people, now the same families, three generations, 724 families across 85 years, because most research that gets done is snapshots. You know, I could take a snapshot of people who are teenagers today and what they think about or how they feel, and people who are in their 40s and people in their 80s. But to follow people from the time they're teenagers all the way through life into old age, into death, is completely unusual. And one of the reasons why it's unusual is that most longitudinal studies end before 10 years are up because too many people drop out. But we've had a retention rate of 84%, which is amazing. I mean, it's just, it's like unheard of. And so by keeping so many people with us all this time, we've been able to glean these stories of lives and then put numbers to them so that we both have stories and statistics about what keeps us happy.
Oh my gosh, that is amazing. And you know, I'm going to flip. I've dog-eared the book. I've read it all over the place. I'm going to flip to the back of the book because there's certain things that caught my attention. I mean, a lot of things caught my attention, but just to take people on a journey through this exploration of happiness, because you're going to give them what it is. We're going to get to that point. But one of the things right at the end in your last chapter, it's never too late to be happy, the conclusion chapter, you talk about living an examined life. You have a subheading. And that reminded me of Marcus Aurelius's quote that I quote so often, the unexamined life is not worth living. And that this then you and if you continue to read there, I'll let you take away with the details, but basically you ask people whether there was an influence of asking them to examine their lives, if that actually influenced the outcome and the results, and you can answer that. But I found that fascinating because part of the work I do is with QEG and with a bit of quantum physics and that kind of thing. And how we can look at our lives influences what's going on. So I found that fascinating. So I want you to talk about that and I'll come back and ask you specific questions. And then I want to also dive into the concept of us not recognizing that we may not be experts on our own lives. When we accept this and we accept that we may not have all the answers, we step into the realm of possibility. Now, I love that. I absolutely love that. So I want to talk about the realm of possibility. And as I said, I will go back and walk you through each question. I want to lay a nice foundation for the listeners to get really excited. And then you also ask the question that we've asked from the beginning of time. Do I matter? And I loved how you answered that in the paragraph. The question of mattering, of leaving something for future generations and being part of something bigger than ourselves is not just about our personal achievements. It's about what we mean to other people. And that starts giving the hint towards where does happiness truly lie, which I'm going to let you reveal. And then you talk about filling in the gaps. And you talk about, as we both know, we were discussing just before we started the interview, that there's a whole world that's grown up around the science of happiness. I mean, there's podcasts on it. There's endless books on it. But your book is different. It's different because of what you said in the beginning about these literally from 1938, you've 750 families through all these years, 85 years, 84% retention rate. I mean, this is highly exciting. It's incredible. And the results, as you say, you can't pick up the nuance of someone drinking a cup of coffee or answering the phone, but there is data to show some basic principles which you'll share. So I just found that extremely exciting, and I don't want to give it that. I'm going to ask the other parts in a moment about the fourth R and that kind of thing. So let's jump back to starting here about the examined life and what you found, how the study ran and why you actually asked that question in the first place.
Yeah, well, let me tell you about the study. So the study, as I said, started in 1938, and it started as two studies that didn't know about each other when they started. One was a study of Harvard College undergraduates, 19-year-olds, who were thought by their deans to be fine, upstanding young men. And so, you know, if you want to study normal development, you study all white men from Harvard, right? It's so politically incorrect. And so So first of all, it's a very privileged sample, very male, very white, right? Then in addition, there was a study at Harvard Law School of juvenile delinquency, and they gathered a whole bunch of boys of middle school age, like maybe average age 12, 13 when they began. And their question was, if we take children from really troubled families, not just poor, but really troubled families, plagued by domestic violence and parental illness and so many problems, how is it that some children are able to stay on good developmental paths, are able to stay out of trouble and to thrive? So they were both studies of thriving, one privileged, one quite underprivileged. And then we quickly brought in spouses as they grew up and married. And then we brought in their children, more than half of whom are female. So now we have quite a gender balanced group of people. And then you asked me, okay, why did we ask people about how examining their lives influenced them, how that mattered? And what we asked was, you know, we've sent you questionnaires regularly. We've come to your homes and interviewed you. We've asked you to think about your life regularly, over and over again. And of course, some people said, oh, it's just a nuisance. It hasn't affected me at all. But most people said, this has been one of the most important experiences of my life, because I know that regularly I'm going to be asked to think about my life, to reflect on where I'm going, to examine my life. And they said, this has undoubtedly had an effect on where I have taken my life. So what we find is that, you know, you as a scientist know that what you ideally want to do in science is leave the field you're observing completely unaltered, untouched, right? So we shouldn't have anything to do with our participants. But of course, we have to. We send them these questionnaires. We ask them to come to our lab and we work with them. But in addition, we were not hands-off at all. We sent them birthday cards. We sent them thank you notes when they would complete a questionnaire. We sent them condolence letters if someone near to them died. So we were not hands-off. We were very different. And the reason why we think so many people have stayed with us for 85 years is because they feel like they're a community and they feel like they are giving a gift to science, which they are. And we keep reminding them of that. So it's a very particular kind of study that you know, has that edge to it of, well, we are influencing the people we study.
That is so brilliant, because in the world, the way the science has gone, that you've got to have this non-biased, random controlled, which is not, I mean, they're good, it's good. But at the end of the day, you can't not be influenced in some way by some connection. And if it's so clinical, you know, as a therapist as well, that it's the therapeutic alliance that's the most important thing in the relationship versus whatever technique you happen to be using. And so this thing of you sending the birthday cards, the community aspect really gave you the answer to happiness.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
Let's talk about the four R's. You found the fourth R.
Well, the fourth R, what we found that at first we didn't believe when the data began to show us this, we found that the strongest predictor of who's going to be happy and who's going to be healthy as they go through life is the warmth of our relationships and the strength of our connections to other people. And we thought, okay, it stands to reason that if you have better relationships, you'll be happier. That makes sense. But how could relationships get into our bodies? How could relationships that are good make it less likely that we'll get coronary artery disease? How could it make it less likely that we get type 2 diabetes or arthritis? That just didn't make any sense. And then other research groups began to find the same thing. And as you know, Caroline, as a scientist, you don't want to just take one study as proof of anything. You want many studies to point in the same direction. And when we saw that other studies were finding the same thing, we said, okay, we can have confidence in this finding about relationships keeping us healthier. And then so for the last 10 years, we've been spending our time studying how this works. Like, what are the mechanisms by which relationships affect our health?
Hey guys, if you didn't know already, I have a new book coming out August 8 on how to help your child clean up their mental mess. This book is the blueprint and guide I wish I had as a parent. It's packed with practical, simple, and scientific techniques and scripts for parents, caregivers, teachers, grandparents, and guardians to help children become more mentally and emotionally resilient. There are guides on how to use the neurocycle with your child to deal with loneliness, self-doubt, sibling issues, and so much more. If you pre-order now before August 8th, you'll get access to some really amazing bonus content, like a free webinar on how to mentally prepare for back to school, and I will be answering your questions about the book during this webinar. To pre-order now, go to mentallyresilientkids.com or drleaf.com. The book is also available on Amazon and wherever you buy your books, plus the audiobook is narrated by me. Let's go to mentallyresilient.com and pre-order before August 8th to get access to these amazing bonuses. The link and details will be in the show notes. This is so powerful. You know, it's looking at a matrix as opposed to just the linear reductionistic one variable causing another variable. Because I know when we designed the pilot that we now are repeating with a larger sample, there were so many. We looked at the brain. We looked at the various different biological measures, blood, telomere. I have a validation scale looking at the mind management, self-regulation, psychological. We looked at quantitative. We looked at people's stories. There were so many. It was a whole matrix, and it was so much more realistic because you're not looking at a person in isolation. I mean, this is tiny compared to what you have done. But the point I'm making is that these years of us understanding that chronic unmanaged stress causes physical illness and causes challenges with the mind, and that it's embodied, that it shows up. We saw it in the telomeres, and we saw it in the brain, and we saw it everywhere. And this is established. This is, as you and I both know, this is established research. So you can't divorce the two. So it's just the holistic approach of your study. The study is unreal. It's fantastic.
Right. Well, and what we ended up doing was adding some of the measures you're describing. We added, you know, we drew blood for DNA methylation studies, studying heart rate variability. We brought people into our laboratory, stressed them out deliberately with the Trier social stress test, and then watched how they recovered from stress. We put them into the scanner to do functional MRIs. We showed them happy and sad images to see how their brains operated when they were shown emotionally valenced images. All of these things to get different windows on well-being and different windows on stress regulation.
Mm, that's incredible. So you to come back to the four R's, what I want to do is just drop into the listeners' minds the answer that you found, and then we can dial back and go into a little bit more detail. But would you mind to talk about the three R's and then how you pretty much found the fourth R? Well, you didn't find it, but the research showed it, that there's four R's.
Well, I think, aren't the three R's the traditional school ones?
Yes.
Reading, writing, and
arithmetic. Yes. Everyone knows the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Yeah.
But
so what we said, because of our findings, is that the fourth R in school, in the way we educate our children, should be relationships. And that what we know, there's a whole field of socio-emotional learning that where people have developed hundreds of really good programs that teach children in school, this is what feelings are. This is what it's like to get angry. This is what it's like to have an argument with my friend. This is what bullying looks like. And then help children manage their feelings, help children avoid bullying, stop it when they see someone else being bullied, all of these things. And what they find is when they teach children about relationships, the fourth R, they do better at reading, writing, and arithmetic. They're much less likely to get involved with drugs. They're much less likely to be disciplinary problems in school. So many good things happen if we teach about relationships. And of course, what we want to do and what the book does is we're teaching ourselves as adults about relationships, because we all need this.
It's so important. You know, I'm sure you probably saw it, but it's always, you know, January the 1st, there's always people, the detoxes that people come out with and all the goals and all the typical stuff. And there was one article that caught my eye, and I'm probably pretty certain you probably saw it being in the field you are, and it was The Real Truth About the Science of Happiness. And at the end of the day, I think they quoted you, they did quote you, I'm pretty certain, but it was that the most important thing, it's not all the green juices and the exercises and all those, you know, they play a role. It is relationships. It's that fourth R. It's deep, meaningful connections. And this is something that the ancient philosophers spoke about. It's something that we, and you talk, you say it so nicely in your book. I'm not sure which sentence it was, but we need all these things. Let me see if I can find it quickly. The fact that a few things affect the quality of our lives as much as our connections to others. And that just in itself is, it's a simple statement, but it's such a powerful statement. Few things in life affect the quality of our lives as much as our connection. And we have got in the last, I think, 40 years, if not longer, but especially with the technological age and industrial revolution and all these things, is that we've become so focused on the external. And we've become quite reductionistic and a pull for every ill and quick fixes. And I say that because, you know, you're in a world where people will think, hey, I don't want to do talk therapy. Can't you just give me a tablet to make it go away? Because one of the other factors, and that leads me to my next question, one of the other factors that you talk about is it's relationships, which is priority. And then you talk about how people deal with adversity or how they deal with the experiences of life. I don't know if I've paraphrased that correctly. And that I'd love you to just talk about that.
Well, and what we found when we asked people in our study, so the first generation we studied were born during the Depression. They grew up. They were kids during the Depression. And then the Harvard men were of an age to go off to World War II. And most of them saw combat, saw great suffering. And many of them watched comrades being killed, terrible trauma. And when we asked these people, how did you get through these big global crises like the Depression and the Second World War? To a person, they mentioned their relationships. So with the Depression, they said, it was my neighbors. We shared what little we had with each other so we could all get through these horrible times. And the soldiers in World War II said, it was the people who wrote to me from back home. It was my fellow soldiers. I knew that there were people who were rooting for me, who cared about me. And so what we find is that these big challenges that come along in our lives, whether they're personal challenges, you know, it might be an illness or a financial reversal, or these big global challenges like the pandemic, that all of them are made easier if we are supported by people that we have good connections with. And so relationships don't just make us happier, they buffer the unhappy times. And that's really important.
Oh, I love that. Can you talk a little bit more about that buffering the unhappy times and pushing through adversity, which linked to that one statement that I read of yours about having the possibilities, the sort of possibility type mindset? I'll read it to you again. Asking honest questions about ourselves is the first step towards recognizing that we may not be experts in our own lives. When we accept this and we accept that we may not have all the answers, we step into the realm of possibility, and that is a step in the right direction. I love that concept of possibilities. That's uncertainty, challenges, and all these things, and that seemed to be a big factor in your research, relationships and the possibility mindset around adversity.
Well, one of the things we know, and we study this, we study coping mechanisms, defense mechanisms, and we know that people who are falsely certain, who say, I know myself, I know what's what, I know this person, I know my spouse, I know, you know, my family, that those people often close themselves off to possibility. And that the best expression of that comes from one of my Zen teachers. Sunryu Suzuki was a great Zen teacher who said, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few.
I read that. I thought it was beautiful.
And yes, and what he's talking about is that if we're really sure we know everything, that we close ourselves off to learning, to surprise, that if we remain curious about everything, including ourselves, that there's that possibility that you talked about. So, you know, it can be certainly in our relationships, we can be curious about, you know, I've been married for 37 years. So my wife and I have dinner just about every night. of those 37 years. And one of the instructions of my Zen teacher was this. It was, notice what's here now that I have never noticed before. And he said, take that to a new, to an encounter that you think you know perfectly well. So when I sit down for dinner with my wife, if I'm starting to feel bored, I call up that question, what's here right now? Either what's here about my partner or what's here between us that I've just never seen before or never noticed, right? And if we can do that, we can do it with work colleagues who we think we know so well. We can do it, you know, we can do it anywhere. And it adds a kind of aliveness to each encounter.
Oh, I love that. I've been married for 35 years. So just two behind you. And it keeps that excitement. It keeps that openness. It keeps the openness to learning. And isn't there, I can't remember the exact quote, but there's a proverb as well that talks about when we don't, if we think we know everything, that's when wisdom ends or something like that. It's along those, yeah, along those lines.
Yeah.
And so in terms of the study, you, that openness to possibility seemed to be quite a big factor in terms of relationships. And can you explain that, how that related to the actual study and how it relates to happiness?
There were people who really closed off their options. So for example, they were sure that they weren't any good at relationships, so they stopped trying. And those people closed themselves off. They became more and more isolated. We have a story in the book about a man who did that. He was a Harvard man, but he ended up living in a trailer in Montana all by himself, out of touch with his wife and children and his beloved sister and so many people. We had people who closed off possibility. Then our happiest people were people who kept saying, oh, what's coming my way now? And were open, whether it was a new hobby, a new career possibility, a new friendship. You know, we have a chapter in the book called It's Never Too Late, where we tell stories of people who thought it was too late for them and then find friends at a point in their life when they never expected to, or find love when they never expected to. And so what we find is that ability to remain open to, like, oh, what's going to come along today that I don't expect, that is a mindset that allows us to be prepared. You know, there's a saying, luck favors the prepared mind. Well, luck happens, and we never know when it's going to happen, but we can be open to it and open to seeing, oh, this could be a new door opening for me. And the happiest people in our study were those people.
That's fascinating. You know, that quote that you said about luck favors a prepared mind, I mean, that's actually the wrong thing completely. I mean, it kind of gets you stuck, because then you think, I've got to be prepared. And then if I'm not prepared, I can't be open to possibilities. Yeah. I'm so prepared that I can't see the opportunities and the possibilities and all those kinds of things.
Well, you're right. And we don't want to say, my gosh, you have to prepare for everything. But I'll give you an example. So I was not trained as a researcher. I was trained as a clinical psychiatrist and loved that, working with patients. But then I decided I'd really like to learn to study some of the things in research that I was seeing in my office with patients. So I went back to school and I took a lot of courses and trained myself and got good training in how to do research. Well, then it turned out that the third director of the Harvard study, George Valiant, was looking for a successor. Now, if I hadn't prepared myself with some research skills, he would never have thought to ask me, and I would have never been able to say yes. So that's where the prepared mind came together with a piece of luck, which is that my predecessor said, oh, this person might want to inherit this study. So that's what I mean, that there are ways that we can, you know, it's a combination of doing what we can to better ourselves, to make our lives good and to develop skills, but then be open to luck, because there's a lot of luck in our lives that happens.
I like that. So it's actually the preparedness that is an open-minded preparedness. It's a preparedness of possibilities. as opposed to preparedness, that this is actually one pathway.
Because exactly.
I think a lot of people associate being prepared, well, that's it. And then people get stuck and they get very stressed out because they, oh, that didn't work out, now what kind of thing? I'm a failure. They can't learn and whatever, that kind of situation.
Well, exactly. I mean, actually, the reason why I went back and learned to do research in my 40s was because I found that I didn't like being an administrator. For me, running things wasn't enjoyable. It is for many people, and I'm so glad it is because they're people who run things very well, and I'm so grateful, but I didn't like it. And so this thing that I thought I was supposed to like was there, and I said, well, that's not working out for me. Now what do I do? And so it is this openness to, well, let me try this. And if it doesn't work out, okay, at least I tried. And so to your point, I thought I was on one path, and then it wasn't okay for me. And so I said, okay, I'm going to just see how I can make a change towards something that resonates more with my natural interests.
Okay, so this study has obviously impacted you. It's very evident by the way you write, by the way you speak, and just by your whole disposition. I mean, you're just so gentle and kind, and it's coming, it's very evident. So my question, this, I think you went in with this mindset, but how has this study affected you personally, your mental health, and just how you view life?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, when you see all these life stories, I mean, I can go to my office and pull out a file drawer and look at one family's file, and I could read the life stories of family members as they go from 1938 all the way to the present. And that's, first of all, it's an amazing privilege to be able to do that. But what it's also done for me is it's helped me to see how many infinite paths there are through life, right? And that's been helpful to know that there are so many ways to live a life and to live a good life and a meaningful life, right? And that's been helpful, that there are so many possibilities. There is no one way. There is no one way. And that's been important to me. In fact, there's a quote by Joseph Campbell, the man who wrote The Power of Myth. He wrote, "If the path before you is clear, you're probably on somebody else's path." That everybody's path is different, you know? And boy, studying all these lives has really shown me that. And then, you know, to your question, how has it affected me? Well, one of the things it's done is it's made me take much better care of my own relationships. So, you know, I'm a Harvard professor. I could work 24/7. I could just sit here on my computer, writing, editing, you know, doing email forever.
Yeah, there's enough to keep you busy.
Yeah, there's plenty. And especially once my kids were grown and I didn't have them pulling me away saying, "Dad, come do this," which I love, but they're gone. And then I realized, you know, I could just work 24/7. And so what I've had to do because of my own research findings is take care of my relationships. So, you know, this weekend, I took a walk with two different people and had a Zoom call with a friend I hadn't seen in 25 years. And I just make myself arrange these things. And I'm much more active in this than I used to be. And what I find is that my relationships are more alive and vibrant than they used to be because of it.
Wow, I love that. This is advice that everyone needs because you've seen the study, you've got the life experience. I love the infinite pathways, and I love how you've actually re-looked at the way you're running your life. And you talk about the busyness, the hustle. It's literally the hustle culture where it's almost glorified to do the 24/7 situation, which kind of led people to think, well, is that the solution to happiness? It's not. I mean, you can honestly say that's not the solution to happiness.
It's not. I mean, you know, and getting rich, being famous, high achievement at work, which is what people often think they need, those things don't make you unhappy. They just don't make you happy. They're different, right? There are very happy people who have those things and desperately unhappy people who have those things. They're just not relevant to happiness. What I will say, though, is that having our basic material needs met is very important for happiness. So we find is you have to have enough money to have food on the table and a roof over your head and to be able to take care of your family for sure. But that once you get beyond, there was an estimate a few years ago of $75,000 annual income in the US, and it's different in different places, but that once you get above meeting your basic needs, your happiness doesn't go up much at all. So you could make $75 million and you won't be that much happier than if you make $75,000. So that's the important point.
If I summarize what you're saying in terms of the taking time to focus on the relationship, the question that I was going to ask you about what matters, you asked the question in your book, what matters? And it's the ancient question that we've asked since the beginning of time. Am I hearing you correctly saying that what really matters, what you've seen matter in your own life with your own wisdom and your own being a professor at Harvard, being married all these years, living the years that you've lived, plus the study, is that relationships, taking the time to develop the deep meaningful relationships is big, and that, how do the possibilities to you'll get through the adversity concept, and then also these infinite pathways that really got my attention, because you and I both know, and so does most people who read anything in the news, that we are talking about a whole generation of young people that are really battling with their mental health more than ever before. And I kind of think that we're looking at it wrong, because since the beginning of time, mankind has battled, and every generation faces something that affects the generations in different ways. But just having, I'd love to talk about that as well. But the infinite pathways that really got my attention, because that's something that I think is so important to be able to share with our youth, is that there isn't just one pathway.
Exactly. And that's what I love actually about the ways that life has opened up. I mean, think about the LGBTQ community and how many ways there are to be a person, right? And in a way that it was unacceptable. Even when we started our study, there were no gay people in our study. Well, of course there were gay people. We just couldn't talk about it. And so now people are much freer to lead the lives that feel most authentic to them. And I think if there's one message that comes out of our study, it's that it's really important to lead an authentic life with people in relationship with whom you can be your authentic self. That's a really core part of what we call a good relationship.
Mm, that's what matters. It's being that authentic. It's being that authentic in the relationships, and it's seeing the infinite pathways with the possibilities mindset. Just a little summary there. That's very, very, very exciting. Now let's take this incredible work that you're doing in this discussion and just transition for a moment to how we started the discussion already, but how mental health is being viewed. You've been in this field for many, many decades now and trained as a psychiatrist, trained as in psychotherapy, Zen master, researcher, you've done the study, you're interacting with people, you've got these beautiful stories, as you say, you can read a family over all these years. What do you feel about the way that mental health has been spoken about in the current era, time frame, and how it's being managed?
I'm more hopeful. I mean, mental health used to be in such a dark corner of our culture, right? Where we never spoke about it. In fact, I think it was Tom Eagleton was a candidate for vice president. And when it was revealed that he had had a previous episode of depression, he couldn't run for vice president. Like, what, one in five people has a serious episode of depression in their lifetime. So, now what's encouraging to me is that we are talking about it more. And in fact, celebrities are talking about it more, and politicians. And I'm so happy for that. That people we admire are willing to say, yes, I've had mental health issues and I've gotten help for it, because there's really good help for the most common mental health issues, as you know. There's really good help. And so I'm hopeful in the way that I think, we used to never be able to use the word cancer or talk about cancer 50, 60, 70 years ago. Now we talk about cancer openly, thank goodness. And that's my hope about what is happening with mental health issues, that we're beginning more and more to be able to talk to each other about it. Because the more we talk to each other, the more people are going to get what they need in terms of help.
I agree with that so much. I love that I'm so pleased you mentioned that the openness. And what I find fascinating about how you work, because you mentioned right at the beginning, as a psychiatrist, you do a lot of talk therapy. And in your talk therapy, and you've mentioned a couple of things. So talk therapy, you've mentioned what really grabs you are people's stories. And you speak about the stories in your book. You give some examples. So from what I'm hearing, you looking at the person in the context of their story. So it's not that their brain is broken. It's that the life things happen to them. And yeah. I'd love to talk about that, because I think there's the one thing that worries me is, yes, this openness is fantastic. But this thing to say, oh, you have those symptoms, oh, therefore, boom, you've got that diagnosis, implying something that's not even proved or it's been disproved, that there's a neurobiological cause. There's an impact, obviously, on the brain and the body, because the mind, brain, and body interact. But the source isn't necessarily that. And there's been so much research and papers released and showing that chemical imbalance and all these kinds of things aren't where we should be looking. We should be looking at the person.
Exactly. And the person includes neurochemicals for sure. And it includes life experience and it includes genetics. And we are just a big, complicated, wonderful collection of factors. And so let's look at everything. I mean, so for example, some of the people I do talk therapy with really are helped by medication. And when medication helps, it never gets in the way of our talk therapy. If anything, it makes it easier for people to be able to suffer less and therefore open up and look at difficult things about their lives. And so it doesn't have to be either or. And so I think what you're talking about in terms of looking at the whole person is what we hope for. That there is no, I wish that there were one solution to something as complex as the human psyche and mental health problems. There's just no single solution and probably won't ever be. We're always going to need to come at these issues with everything we have in our toolbox.
That's wisdom. That is the wisdom, because we've got to stop this. You know, the scientific paradigm is so important, but we've got to be careful that we don't try and think that there's this one-on-one causality and that there's just one thing. It's the complexity has to be returned and the openness, the possibilities like you were speaking about. We've got to keep that.
You know, that we don't know, one size never fits all. That's what I know from studying all these lives. One size never fits all. So if you think, well, depression, you do this kind of therapy. Well, not for everybody, right? And so it requires discernment. It requires careful evaluation and really talking and really listening to each person and finding out who they are, what their life experience has been, and then thinking, oh, okay, what are some of the possible things that might be of help?
I love that. So it's that going from that and then finding a technique or something versus just do this and it'll suppress all the symptoms. That doesn't work. We've got to keep ourselves open-minded to those possibilities, which is just incredible. As I discuss in episode 457 of my podcast, sleep is crucial for our productivity, well-being, and health. It was such an interesting episode. I encourage all of you to go and give it a listen. But sleep is also important for our skin health and restoration. Imagine waking up feeling refreshed, your skin glowing without those pesky dehydration lines and dark circles. Sounds like a dream, right? Well, I'm here to tell you that's not only possible, but it's also within your reach. Magnesium Breakthrough from BioOptimizers has transformed not only my sleep routine, but also my skin health. Here's my nightly routine, which I have been following for a few months. I take 2 capsules of Magnesium Breakthrough with water about an hour before bed. The effects are remarkable. I drift off faster and enjoy deeper, more rejuvenating sleep. When morning comes, I wake up feeling refreshed, energized, and ready to conquer the day. I love that Magnesium Breakthrough combines all 7 different forms of magnesium in a single capsule, giving you the full spectrum magnesium experience you need for optimal results. Unlike other magnesium supplements that might be giving you just 1 to 2 forms of magnesium, its all-natural formula also includes cofactor ingredients to multiply the delivery of magnesium to every cell in your body so that you can absorb all 7 types of magnesium at a very high rate. And for a limited time, visit magbreakthrough.com /Dr. Leaf and enter the code DrLeaf10 to get 10% off your order of Magnesium Breakthrough. Don't let sleepless nights hold you back any longer. Visit magbreakthrough.com/DrLeaf today. The link and details will be in the show notes. Talking about stories, could you maybe share one or two of the stories from the book that really, because there's so many, and I want to respect your time as well, but there's so many beautiful stories, and you've got more in your filing cabinets, as you say.
Oh my gosh, doors, but that's just a tiny fraction
of the fraction, story. It's a fraction. I don't even know how you chose the stories you did, because you probably just had so many that just stood out. So, I mean, I'm just going to quickly read out the chapter names so that people can get a feel. You talk about what makes a good life, why relationships matter, relationships on the winding road of life, social fitness, keeping your relationships in good shape, attention to relationships, your best investment, facing the music, adapting to challenges in your relationships, the person beside you, how intimate relationships shape our lives, family matters, the good life at work, investing in connections. All friends have benefits. Conclusion, it's never too late to be happy. I mean, I absolutely love how you just titled this book. It just tells you in a nutshell why everyone needs it. So it needs to read that. So would you like to share one or two stories that really touched your heart and changed you and that you'll change others?
Probably, I think, you know, two of the most dramatic stories are from one of our least happy people and one of our happiest people. And those seem to be kind of important illustrations of the main points of the book. So one man we call Leo was one of our very happiest people. And one man we call John was one of our least happy people. They were both Harvard College students. So they started out with a lot of privilege. And we thought, boy, these men are set up to have very good lives. One had a wonderful life and one had a miserable life. So Leo, the happy man, actually wanted to be a writer. But when he came back from serving in World War II, his mother was ill. He had to go home and take care of her. So he needed a job. So he got a job as a high school teacher. And he taught history to high school students, to teenagers. And he did that for his whole life. He loved his students. He loved his colleagues. He was a good teacher, had a happy marriage, wonderful children, lots of grandchildren. And he prioritized his connections with people at work as well as at home. John, on the other hand, had a much fancier life. He was a high-powered lawyer. He won a lot of awards. He was quite well-respected, quite well-to-do. He made a lot of money. And he was miserable. He never prioritized relationships. He only prioritized achievement. He didn't feel like he belonged anywhere. Didn't have many friends. He had two unhappy marriages, and he died very lonely and very unhappy, suffering a lot, both physically and emotionally. And so here we have these two people who looked like they started out in the same place and took such divergent paths.
Wow, that is amazing. So people can see in the stories in this book the change, the difference between the two. And the core, if I'm hearing you correctly, tell me if I've heard you correctly, the difference between these two was that Leo prioritized the relationships and in every aspect. And then you show that it's not about the money and that. And that it could have been the other way around. Leo could have made a fortune as well, but it's not so much the money as much as it is those relationships. And if you're going to go for the money side of things and achievements, and there's nothing wrong with that, but if you want to be happy, you're going to have to prioritize relationships.
Yeah, I mean, we think so. And the one thing I do want to say that's important is that it doesn't mean you have to be an extrovert. It does not mean you have to be a party animal. Not at all. You can be quite shy. All of us are somewhere on a spectrum between extroverts and introverts. And everything is fine. There's nothing abnormal about either end of those spectrum. That really being an introvert just means you want fewer people in your life. That being with a lot of people is exhausting and draining. And so introverts get refueled by some good alone time. But what we think is that everybody needs at least one person who they can go to in times of trouble, who will have their back, who will be there for them. and that otherwise there's no correct number of friends you should have or connections, not at all. You don't need an intimate partner. You don't need to live with someone. You can live alone and get all of these benefits. It's really about the connections you have, it's not about whether you have a marriage license or a roommate or you have lots of friends at lots of parties. It's not about that at all.
Oh, wow. That is just one of the most freeing things that everything you've said has been a pearl of wisdom, but that is so important what you've said, because you kind of just shot a whole lot of myths out of the water in one shot. That it's, because I get asked the question often, and I've been interviewed on the concept of, are you only going to be happy if you have that intimate partner? If you have that, you can live alone and choose the amount of people that works for you, because there's no cookie cutter kind of specification. So it doesn't mean you have to be the party animal. You can be authentic and do what you, and create the world that you need. And I mean, you just freed me up in a certain aspect, because if I may share just very quickly, I'd love to just very quickly share. My husband and I work together, and we've got four children. They were all in our business, all four children. And my husband, he's the CEO. One daughter's the producer. One runs admin. One is on my research team. And even my son, who's a contractor, co-authors children's storybooks with me. And, you know, I am the most happy when I've got a great extended family too. But I get so much satisfaction in my marriage. And I remember someone in this relationship, because we're together all the time. We're working together all the time. And we've got friends. We've got wonderful friends and family. But that's what satisfied my need greatly is this relationship in the business, because we all love this and I love my research. So I kind of like feel almost guilty sometimes that all my needs are being met in sort of one, which is okay, because people have said to me, hey, you should go out more. You should have more time with friends. And it's exhausting. I'll do it when I want to and I love it when I do it. But this, I feel totally satisfied. So there's another little story for you.
And that's so important, because your way of meeting your relationship needs is going to be different from mine or anybody else's. And it sounds like you know that this feels right to you. And if it doesn't feel right at a certain point, you'll make some changes, but not right now.
That's the beauty of it. You're saying such incredible things. And that's why I thought, let me bring that example in, because my own children have different ways that they relate. And one needs lots of friends and one has, you know, so it changes. That's the other key thing I'm hearing you say. What works now is okay. But if it changes, it's okay. Have the possibility.
Yes. And that's something we find in our most successful relationships, whether they're marriages or friendships or family relationships, that each of us is always changing, if you think about it, that there's so much change that happens in our lives, in ourselves, right? So if you think about it, any two people, each one is a change, is someone who's constantly changing. So the question is, can we keep noticing who we are, each of us is, and appreciate and embrace the change in the other person and let that other person change, not attempt to freeze that other person into what they have been before, or freeze our relationship into something it had been, but to allow each of us as people to evolve and allow the relationship to evolve.
Oh, wow. The examined life. It's examining yourself constantly. That's what I'm hearing you say. Wow, that is incredible. I feel so privileged to have spoken to you. It's a delight. It's an absolute delight. And I would love to invite you back again, because I think there's so many things we could dive into deeper. It would be a privilege and an honor.
This is such a nice conversation.
It's been amazing. Really? I've enjoyed every moment, and I'm sorry that it's coming to an end, but I want to respect your time, and you've given me nearly an hour of your time, and I really appreciate that. And I just want to tell everyone that this book is really beautiful. I mean, it's not just it's not a quick fix mentality. This is a life skill. It's something that we need as a life skill. It's at our essence and core who we are. We need these relationships, and it's easy to read, and it's a great book. So I want to thank you as well for writing it. It's wonderful, and it's been a delight.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope we get to do something together
absolutely,
again.
Absolutely. Yeah. We will definitely have to reach out and have you back on the podcast. So thank you so much.
All right.
I hope you found today's podcast interesting and helpful. If you want more tips and help with managing anxiety, depression, and mental health, be sure to visit my website at drleaf.com and to sign up for my weekly newsletter, where I also include a schedule of my speaking events and so much more. And follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Just look for Dr. Caroline Leaf. Also, I love seeing all your posts on social media about this podcast. I love seeing what resonates with you and what you've learned. So be sure to continue posting and tagging me and letting me know what you think and how these tips worked out for you. And don't forget, leave a review and keep spreading the word about this podcast. Thank you for joining me today. I really hope you learned something new and helpful. Till then, I'm Dr. Caroline Leaf. This podcast represents the opinions of myself and my guests. The content here should not be taken as medical advice. The content here is for educational and informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional for any individual medical questions you may have. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors.